Okay, we're doing Parashat Tumah, a quick overview. The parasha begins by describing the raw materials that people could donate for the semblance of the tabernacle, the Mishkan. And then the parasha actually describes how we build an aron, an ark that's made of wood, a shittim wood, which was lined with pure gold. And then that the aron has to have four rings, and those rings you put two poles, which were also made of wood, and then lined with gold. And then you could carry the aron, the ark, with those poles, and the poles stayed there permanently. On top of the aron, you had a slab of gold from which protruded two angel figures, what are called kruvim, no questions yet, and Hashem is going to appear and speak to Moshe from between those two kruvim. After we describe the aron, we move on to a description of the shulchan. The shulchan, literally meaning table, is an interesting table. You have a table made of wood, and then you line it with gold, and then you put a rim around it made of gold. And then the table also has poles that it was carried with. And then on the sides of the table, you had shelves. You had six shelves, or actually five shelves on each side, special shelves we'll still discuss. And basically, you couldn't see the table. Meaning, for all the table was worth, you never saw anything. The table had one loaf on one side and one loaf on the other side. And then on the shelves, you had stacked up five more loaves of bread. And the shelves took up the whole space of the table. So that's our shulchan. Then we go on to the menorah. So we know what the menorah is, right? Special lamp, has a central gold beam, three branches on the left, three branches on the right, a total of seven cups of oil on top. And it's all made of one solid block of gold. Then we have the description of how we have to build the Mishkan itself, with the different layers of roofing, the different cloths that would form the roof. And then the description of the beams that would actually form the building of the Mishkan and the sockets, the copper sockets in which the beams stood. And the description of the curtains that would be within the Mishkan. And then we go on to discuss the Mizbeach, the altar, and the utensils that were used to work on the altar. And we reach the end, Shvi'i, and the description of the courtyard of the Mishkan. And that's our parsha in a nutshell. So we have a description of a few vessels. Which vessels did we describe? We described the Aron. We described the menorah. What else? The shulchan. And the shelves of the shulchan. And then we described the building of the Mishkan itself. Right? And at the end, we have the Mizbeach. Yes, so that's our parsha in a nutshell. Okay. So let's begin. Yes. I don't know. Don't know. The Talmud derives what the width is going to be, but I don't know why the Torah omitted it. I don't know. It's not. Aron? So the kaporet, the slab of gold, the one on top, we don't have a description of how thick it would be. Okay, let's begin. Number one, the measurements we're going to use. So, what's an amma? How long is an amma? Help me out, guys. What's an amma? Okay, an amma is the length from the tip of your, what's this called, index finger? What, middle finger, index finger? From the tip of your index finger down to your elbow, okay? The average length of that, that's an amma. So if we want to gauge an amma, how do we gauge an amma? A footstep. When you walk, when you advance a foot, it says if you want to know, you're allowed to walk 2,000 amas outside a city. 2,000 footsteps, we're assuming, is 2,000 amas. Meaning, every time you advance, when you take a step, that the average step is an amma. And if you measure that, you'll see, when you take an average step, okay, so my step, I'm a short guy, my average step is this. And if you measure my amma, you'll see it's about that. You can do it on your own. You'll see. Okay, so if we want to measure amos, we walk. Okay? We want to measure 1, 2, 3, 4.
So now we know what four amos are. How big is an amo? So we know another measurement, but before we go on to the measurement, I want to tell you how I teach this to kids, because it's a good way to teach it, and then you guys can use this when you'll ever be teaching a class. So when I teach children, I start with a story. We're all traveling. We're on a boat, and suddenly there are tremendous winds, and we try to ensure that the boat doesn't capsize. And before we know it, we hear cracking, and the boat is breaking apart, and everyone grabs a plank, and the boat starts sinking, and we're out to sea, and we're tossed here and there, and before we know it, we're all separated, and we find ourselves floating. Each one has a plank, and we see an island, and we try swimming. We make it out to that island. We're on the island. We've all made it safely, but we have nothing. So we have to figure out a way how we're going to build a new ship and make our way back home. How do we do that? So what's the first thing we need? Who knows? What's the first thing we need?
Wood.
He says wood. What do you guys say? What's the first thing we need?
Desire to build.
Measurements. Desire to build. You know what the first thing we need is?
Water.
We need a leader. If you don't have a leader, this one's going to say do that, and that one's going to say do that, and everyone's going to pull in a different direction, and you get nothing done, right? So the first thing you need is leadership. Without that, everything's in disarray. So if you can form a team with a defined leader, we can try to work as a team and get things done. So we appoint a leader. When you're dealing with a group of kids, it's always nice to work with them. How do we decide who the leader is? And suddenly you see how each one wants to be the leader. Each one thinks they know best. And then you see how difficult it is to appoint a leader. But you have to realize that without a leader, everyone's going to die. So, okay, we appoint a leader. Now the leader says, he formulates a plan. We need to build the ship. So we need planks that are going to be this big. How do you measure how big it is? Well, we don't have tape measures with us. So how do we measure how big something's going to be? And then you look with the kids and you see what a tefach is, how you can measure things with hand widths. If we each have to go and cut down a tree to size, so that's a good way of measuring hand width, right? That's a way of measuring when you have nothing else to measure. So in the days of our sages, this was how they measured hand width. How many hand widths is an amma? Okay, gentlemen, check yourselves. How many tfachim, how many hand widths are going to constitute an amma? An arm's length.
Five.
One, two, three, four, five, and then some on mine. Okay, it's about five, you want to say. Okay, so we have three types of ammas in halacha. We have an amma that's five tfachim, we have an amma that's six tfachim, and when we speak about the amma of the Mishkan, how big is that amma? So there's a machloket, and this machloket goes throughout all the vessels. Machloket Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda in the Mishnah, whether the amma is going to be six tefachim wide or five tefachim wide. Did you guys learn about this yet? Now, how does that amma, how does that affect us? What was in the Aron?
The tablets, the staff.
Which tablets?
The second.
Both of them. Some say all the Torah until that point.
Yeah, and the original Torah scroll.
What else was in the Aron? So, happens to be machlokes. One opinion says that both sets of tablets were there. Everyone knows that. Luchot v'shivrei luchot ba'aron. The Aron housed the broken tablets that Hashem made and the whole tablets. How big were the tablets? Who knows? How big were the tablets? Moshe came down from Sinai 2 weeks ago. We read about it with the two tablets. How big were they? How big were they?
So, the original ones were bigger, no?
No, same size. How big were the luchos? How big were the luchos? Each one of the luchos was an amma by an amma by half an amma, meaning six tfachim by six tfachim by three tfachim. So let's see. One, two, three, four, five, six. Okay, this wide, each tablet. So two tablets were about this wide. Moshe's a 20-footer. That's not a big deal for him to carry that, okay? Right, Moshe's 10 amas, 20 feet. Okay, so this wide, each tablet, right, we said this wide and this high, okay, and half width, so it's about the width of this table, right? So that's a rock this big.
That's not, you know, that's heavy. That's one, and then another one. So I couldn't even put my hands around them. I could barely put my hands around them. But Moshe was able to. So that's the size of the two tablets. And we have the broken tablets and the whole tablets in the Aron. We have a Sefer Torah, Torah scroll. Someone mentioned the staff. We have Mun. There are two opinions as to whether the Torah was actually inside the Ark or there was a shelf outside and the Torah was placed there. Okay, so let's begin. We're up to Parshas Truma. Now we have our measurements. We have an Amma. Let's deal with our raw materials. So what raw materials were used in the temple, in the Mishkan? Help me out. Which raw materials? What raw cedar materials? So we know gold was used. What else? Silver, copper, cedar wood, atzei shittim. Where'd they get atzei shittim from? They took it out of Egypt. Okay, you all know that. Very good. Where? What else? What other raw materials were used? What is tchelet? Oh, what is tchelet? 70 years. Okay, so tchelet is, firstly, the material is wool. That's tchelet, by definition, is wool that was dyed with the blood of a chilazon. What is a chilazon? It's some kind of fish. Rashi says it comes out of the sea once every 70 years, and its blood is a greenish-bluish tinge, and that's what's used to dye this wool. It's very expensive. Our tzitzis has to have a string that's dyed with that. Rambam writes that the blood of the chilazon is black, and if you mix it with the different chemicals, it turns blue. Now, where'd they get the chilazon from? Where'd they fish it? Out in the desert. Where are you going to get a fish? So some say they brought the dye with them from Egypt, and others say that you were able to fish it in the Yam Suf. If you went to the Yam Suf, you could fish the chilazon. So they were able to fish it out of there. So we have tcheles. So that's this bluish wool. We have sheish. What is sheish? What is sheish? Sheish is linen that's white. Okay, so we have tchelet, blue wool. We have sheish, which is white linen. What's argaman? Oh, purplish, reddish wool. Again, the material is wool, and it's dyed to that color. Now, we have different opinions as to what color is argaman. Some say it's purplish, some say it's goldish. So that's argaman. Then we have tolat shani. What is tolat shani?
I forget who brings it, but it comes from a fruit that they had, and they would basically have worms inside of it, and they would dry it out, and they would crush it, and then they would put it in water, and they would put it into the wool.
Very nice. Okay, so two opinions as to whether they called the color sguardo. There are two opinions as to whether they got that color from the seed itself that they'd pound into the dye, or it was the worm that was in the seed. So at any rate, again, tolat shani is wool that's dyed this reddish color. So again, what are we saying? We have tcheles, which is wool, argaman, which is wool, and tolat shani, which is wool. Three of them are wool dyed in different colors. Tcheles is which color?
Bluish.
Sheish, argaman is which color? Purplish. And tolat shani is which color? Crimson red. What is sheish? Sheish is white linen. Okay. Now, so far are we all together? We're also going to use gold. Let's start with our first concept is that the Jews have to donate, and they have to donate with proper intentions. They're donating for the sake of Hashem, for the sake of building a temple. What is the pivotal point of the song of Az Yashir? Shem Yiloch Lolam Ve'ed. Nevei Kodshecha. We want a house for Hashem. So there are two opinions as to how we approach Parshas Truma. The Parsha is actually written before the sin of the golden calf. And the question is this the ideal, that the Jews build the temple? Or is it a result of our transgressions? We donated all of our wealth a lot of our wealth. We donated for a golden calf. So Hashem said, here, I'll give you something positive to do with it that will atone for what you've done. Two opinions as to whether the Mishkan, the way it's written, seems to be an ideal. Even if we wouldn't have transgressed, we were supposed to build a Mishkan. Yes, sir?
I read an article that it wrote that the Mishkan was like it's kind of like, it's like very symbolic, and it wasn't supposed to be that way. Like originally supposed to be like completely, it's like without Mitzvah and everything and stuff like that.
Ah, interesting. Okay. Okay, now before we continue, now that you've had 10 minutes of learning and we haven't even started with the details of each vessel, how much time do you guys want to spend on this? 2 minutes, Rabbi, 2 minutes, right? Gentlemen, you have koch? You want to spend another 20 minutes understanding this? Yes? Are we on? Okay. How many people want to give it 20 more minutes? Yeah? Okay, so let's make a run for it. We'll try to get more understanding and then... okay, so all of this was introductory. Okay, so now we start with the Aron. So we have these tall trees called Atzei Shittim, and we're going to make the Aron 2.5 amos long. How long is 2.5 amos, guys? Help me out.
13.
How much is an amah? How many inches? 22 inches. Okay, so that's almost 2 feet. So we said, so our Aron is going to be about this long. Yes? Seder? About this long? We have about 5 feet long. Yes? So that's the length of our Aron. How tall is the Aron? An amah and a half high and an amah and a half wide. So the Aron was about this high, right? And about this wide. So it's a little bit bigger than this table, okay? A little bit longer, a drop wider, and a little bit shorter. It's not so high. What's our Aron made out of, we said? It's made out of wood, Atzei Shittim, and what?
Gold.
It has gold on the outside, gold on the inside, and a gold rim around. The Aron actually represents the holiest part of the Mishkan, right? The Aron has, we have in the Aron...
I have to leave, unfortunately,
Okay. Thank you. The Aron is the holiest part of the temple. Meaning it's like the lifeline of the temple. The whole temple revolves around the Aron. That's in the Holy of Holies. How would they carry the Aron? It was very heavy. They have so much gold. So it would float on their shoulders. Now, I'm going to tell you something that almost no one knows. You could say it as a nice Tver Torah at the Shabbos table. Everyone knows that on top of the Aron you had a gold kaporet, and you had the Kruvim angels come out of it. Their wings are up, and their faces are down. They're looking down, so to speak, at the Torah, right? Everyone knows that. Everyone knows more or less, Maimonides, that you have two in there, so they don't represent God. It's very obvious they represent angels. And everyone knows that they're looking down at the Torah, and Hashem speaks from between them. This all represents that Hashem speaks through the Torah. We're not bowing to these figurines. But what most people don't know is that when the Kohanim would carry the Aron, you had two Kohanim in the back. The poles would go on their shoulder, right? Or two Levim in the back. And the two Levim that would be in the front would be walking backwards. Ah, you knew that? I think most people don't know that. They'd be facing the Aron. So could you imagine that? Four Kohanim, all facing the center. The angels on top facing the center. And this is how they walk in the desert, right? They're walking backwards. Do you ever think about that? Walking backwards, four Kohanim, what the sight must have looked like. You know, the Kohanim in the front are looking at the Aron, the Kohanim in the back are looking at the Aron, everyone's looking at the Aron, and that's how they proceed. So that's the Rambam. The Rambam writes that in Halacha, right, that the Kohanim would be looking at the Aron, even the ones in the front. Okay, so we discussed what goes in the Aron, we discussed the size of the Aron, we discussed that the Aron has a rim. Why does the Aron have a rim? That rim, here you can see a picture of it, has a little gold, like, crown, a little gold rim that goes around. What does that represent? We have three vessels in the temple that will have gold rims, and they represent the three crowns. Which crown is in the Holy of Holies? The crown of Torah, the crown of the Aron. The crown of Torah is accessible to anyone. Anyone who wants to can attain Torah. You don't have to be the son of, the friend of. You want to learn Torah? You can learn Torah. Torah is accessible to all. Yes, sir.
Is it called
Shmuel, right?
Yes. Is it called
Keter, yeah, Keter Torah, the crown of Torah. Okay, so we discussed the Aron. Yes, questions? No. Yes.
Why was that? You said that crown is that the Torah is accessible to everyone, but it was in the part that only the Kohen Gadol goes in.
That's true, but nonetheless, the Torah is accessible to all. That's the that's what it represents. The Kruvim were on the far ends of the Aron. They were facing one another. Their face was small like a child, male and female, the Kruvim, these angels, and their wings would swoop over their heads. Who knows how much of a gap was there from the Kruvim down to the... Ten Tfachim, how do you know that?
I read the Rashi.
Ah, okay.
I have a question. Is that why a Sukkah, if it's 10 feet, it goes on forever? Or the walls, I mean...
No, a different concept in Sukkah. We learn from the term sochechim bechanfehim that the term schach is ten tzvachim. That we learn from there. Now, we have a discussion as to where the poles were actually located. One opinion says the poles were located on the bottom of the Aron, so the Aron was always carried high. The Gemara seems to say they were a third of the way down. So two-thirds of the Aron was beneath the poles and one-third was above. Okay. So... Yes, sir.
Like these measurement specifications, were they like as it is? Like what we see them in the Torah is like just meant to tell us like how the Mishkan was, or is like there's something deeper like behind it?
Oh, you're asking a beautiful question. Okay, I should have said this in the introduction. Thank you. It's a good point. Whenever the Torah tells us physical action with regards to something spiritual. So here, Mishkan, you're serving Hashem, that's something spiritual. Why is the Torah telling me, do something physical, build a Mishkan this way? What difference does it make? Ribono shel Olam, if I make it out of wood, you know, when the Hasmoneans first reconquered the temple, they made a menorah out of wood. They couldn't make one out of gold. Maybe they made it out of copper, maybe out of wood. They couldn't afford anything. They didn't have any money. So does Hashem really care? What difference does it make? Does it matter if the menorah has seven branches or six branches or one branch? What difference does it make? So whenever we are taught by the Torah how to physically do something that's spiritual, so that's where we say this is all Kabbalistic. Technically, practically, shouldn't really matter. Hashem revealed to us that on a Kabbalistic level, this makes a difference. From a simple perspective, from our perspective, what difference does it make? So we start having different understandings of what each thing represents. Why does the Torah have to be put in a wood box that has gold on the inside and gold on the outside? It represents the idea of humility, yet you have to be pure on the inside and pure on the outside, but the core has to be humble, like the wood. You don't see the humble wood. Well, it seems on the outside and the inside gold, but it's not really gold. The real essence of Torah is Moshe Rabbeinu. It's the humility. Moshe doesn't have to be. His heart has to be pure as gold. His actions have to be pure as gold. But Moshe is humble. He's the simple wood. That's Moshe. He's the poorest Jew around. But his actions are wealthy. His thoughts are wealthy. His philosophy is wealthy. The internal and external gold. So each item over here has a Kabbalistic representation. And the size has a Kabbalistic representation. And the shape has a Kabbalistic representation. That's, you're right. That's a very important point. We have an oral tradition. We actually have it till today. A braisa called Braita Demlechta Mishkan. They had an oral tradition together with the written Torah that Moshe gave them, just like we have Mishnah. So they had a lot of oral laws. You know, there were oral tractates on how to become a better person. Oral tractates on human psychology. Did you guys know that? There were actually oral masechtot on human psychology. That's what the Gra writes, that they had, just like we have Shas Mishnayos, so they had other Mishnayos, they had other oral tradition about developing one's Midos. So one of the tractates that they had was called Melechet HaMishkan, how you're supposed to build a tabernacle. And within that, they had the oral traditions of how to do everything that our Parsha says and more. So that's the oral tradition of all this. Okay, so we move on. We discussed the Aron. Okay, here you guys can see a few pictures. You see the Badim were across the length of the Aron, according to most opinions. You see the Kruvim on top. You see the crown. You see the gold on the outside. Here you could see, you know what? Yehuda, you want to take this book, pass it around? We're on the opening pages. Maybe it should be by Gavriel Dweck. So everyone could look on with him. He's in the middle. And if you look at page 23, so you can see the slab of gold. It was all one slab. They knocked out the angel shapes. And that's our Aron. Let's see. Over here you see the Aron made of wood. And you have a gold insert and a gold outside. You see that on page 15. Gold on the outside, gold on the inside. So that's our Aron. If you guys want, pass around my book.
What did that represent? Like, I'm just saying, you were talking about the wood on the inside and the gold on the outside. Wouldn't that represent like the opposite? The fact is that, like, normally, if there's wood on the outside, you see like a humble person, the inside is really like, gold or anything. But, like, the outside, it seems like it's like, kind of like a big shot. Or
right. So that deserves a broader discussion. No, it has a minimum. From the Kruvim, we learn that the minimum of the schach is 10 tefachim.
10
tefachim. We learn that from the Kruvim.
I think that's what the Chanukah candles.
That's 20 amos. That's 20 amos. Okay.
Because they said it was from the pit. They said it was something 10 feet or something like that. And it looks like it was Rek Amayim.
Okay. Okay, onward. Very nice. We have our shulchan. Shulchan is, again, made of wood, the same atzei shittim, lined with gold. And again, the shulchan has the rim around it. That's the next keter, the next crown. And the shulchan also has three rings in which you had poles, but these poles would be removable. By the way, you guys, some of you are planning on traveling. How come the Aron would have poles in it, even in the temple? We weren't traveling anymore. In the desert, you had to have poles in the Aron. But why did the Aron have to have these poles in it for centuries? It was sitting in the same place, in the temple. Yet it had to have poles.
They knew they were going to hide it in destruction.
No.
Is it PCV, like, when you learn Torah, you're always in the mood now?
No, because Torah has to, you have to know that even when you're on the move, Torah's with you. The Aron is always ready to be on the move. It's going to sit centuries in the temple, but it's always ready to be on the move. Torah on the go, right? YU has this program, Torah on the go. So that's one of the ideas the Aron represents. Okay, we'll make a quick overview of the Shulchan. You had bread that was extraordinary bread. It was in this shape. Here, you can see one of these shapes. We're not exactly sure. It was like a U-shaped bread, only on top the U would bend inward. Here you guys can see that. And some say that on the bottom it would come to a point like this. So this was hard bread to manufacture. So there was a special family named Beit Garmu. They had a tradition how to make it so that this bread would last. And they wanted a high price for making their bread. And the rabbis said, we want you to tell people how to make the bread. And they said, no, we don't want to tell anyone how to make this bread. So the rabbi said, it's important. Everyone should know how to make the bread. And Beit Garmu said, no. So Beit Garmu had a good excuse. They said, if we tell, then people will use it for idol worship. So we don't want to tell. In the name of God, we don't want to tell. So they weren't listening to the rabbis, but they had a good excuse. So the rabbi said, okay, you're fired. And they brought in scientists from Alexandria, from Egypt. And the scientists, not Jewish, the scientists guaranteed them that they could make the same bread as Beit Garmu. So the rabbis paid them, and they sat there, and they worked. And they said, here, and it didn't work. And then they tried again, and said, here, and it didn't work. And every time they tried to do it, it didn't work. So the rabbis came back to Beit Garmu, and they said, okay, you're rehired. So Beit Garmu said, no. So the rabbis said, why not? We need you for the temple. And they said, no. So the rabbis said, okay, we'll pay you a little more. So they said no, and they played a hard bargain until they got double. They got double pay. Only when they were willing to pay them double, did Beit Garmu come back. So you'd think Beit Garmu won. Well, guess what? The Mishnah in Tractate Yuma, we learn it every year, recounts how shameful Beit Garmu is. So Beit Garmu's wealth is down the tubes. The temple's being destroyed. But for generations, every little boy knows, boo to Beit Garmu. Everyone knows that's their claim to fame. For generations, we say, Shem Rishaim Yirkav, may the name of the wicked rot about Beit Garmu. Not such a complimentary thing. That's how they go down in history. We're going to learn next week a similar story about Beit Avtinas that knew the secret spices for making the incense, and a similar story.
These were like cursed jobs in a way.
They were blessed jobs. They didn't have to behave this way.
I meant in the way that like, it seems like they somehow corrupted the people that did them.
There's always temptation when you're serving Hashem to corrupt it for one's own personal use. In every service of Hashem, and davening also, and running a shul also, and running a program also, there's always Yetzer Hara. A person has to know that in the service of Hashem, there's also Yetzer Hara. Yes?
So how sure are we that we know how to do this today?
We don't know how to do it. We don't know how to make bread that will save this form and stay fresh for a week. You know, they put the bread on the table on Shabbos, and they would only take it off to be eaten next Shabbos, and it had to stay fresh. So how do you do that? So the first layer of bread went straight on the table. The next layer went on the shelves. So the Torah tells us to make the shelves in a special way. You need air to go through so that it doesn't go bad. So instead of having a flat shelf, you would have three half pipes. And the bread would be lying on those half pipes, so you'd have a breeze going through the bread. So you had these planks. Here you could see the planks on the two sides of the table. And you'd have three half pipes running across the planks so that the bread could lie on these half pipes so that most of the bread was in the air. The half pipes were actually made of solid gold. Let's see a picture of that here. No, it's okay, here. Here you guys see it on page 29. You see these half pipes. So the lowest level of bread was on the table. The next four shelves had three half pipes, and the top shelf had two half pipes. Now, you also needed on the table, you needed to have two cups with frankincense, with lavona. Those two cups, according to one opinion, were in between the two piles of bread. According to the other opinion, each cup was on top of the top bread. Each bread had a cup on it all week. They would have gold forms that they would make the bread in, and then they'd bake it either in a gold or a silver form in the oven. And here you see the different shapes, which are pretty complicated to make. It has to stay, to take that shape, and bake, and be fresh a week later. Okay, so that's our lechem aponim. It has a face on each side. It's like a U. When you draw a U, so a U is facing, the two sides of the U are facing one another. So to this bread, it would come up on the sides and would face one another. So that's our lechem aponim on our shulchan. What's next? We'll talk about the menorah for a minute, and then we'll call it a night. So I want to tell you a beautiful medrash about the menorah. It's a medrash which I wish I knew when I was a kid. The medrash says that Moshe went up Sinai and Hashem told him how to create the menorah. So Moshe went down to teach Bezalel, and on his way down he says, gee, I forgot. So he goes back up the mountain and he says, my master, I forgot. How am I supposed to do the menorah? So Hashem explains it to him a second time. And he goes down the mountain and he forgets a second time. So he comes back up and he says, my master, Hashem, I forgot. I'm sorry. So Hashem teaches it to him a third time. And Hashem shows him. He says, here, you see, you got it? Yes, good. Moshe goes down the mountain and he forgets. And what? And then he comes to Bezalel and he says, Hashem explained it to me, but I forgot. I'm not sure how to do it. And then Bezalel explains to Moshe how it's supposed to be done. And Moshe says, how'd you figure that out? Yeah, that's what Hashem said. Wow. Now, why do I love this medrash? That's why I called him Bezalel. You're like in the shadow of Hashem. You can figure things out that I didn't even tell you. Bezalel was 13, right? So, why do I like this medrash? Because I don't know if you guys have experienced this, but I often experience that I learn something and forget it. I learn it a second time, I forget it. I learn it a third time, I forget it again. I start talking to someone and they figure it out without having learned it once, just like happened to Moshe and Bezalel. So when I hear it happened to Moshe, so I could live with myself a little bit easier. So that's...
Is there another meme on this?
So the Medrash is also teaching us that different people were given different talents because we have different tasks. Moshe's task was not to build the Mishkan. So he didn't have the knack for it. And sometimes we look at other people who can grasp the language Hebrew better, or can grasp their understanding of Talmud better, or have other talents, and we say to ourselves, I'm working so hard and they're getting it so much quicker than me. Okay. So we each work and we each try to grow, and we also have to recognize that we have different talents. So the menorah is going to be of solid gold, and the menorah has an upper cup that houses the oil. That's in Hebrew, what's the cup that houses the oil called? What's it called? What's the cup that has oil and a wick? What's that called in Hebrew? It's called a ner. In modern Hebrew, ner is a candle. In ancient Hebrew and in Talmudic Hebrew, the word ner means the cup that houses the oil and the wick. So we have the ner, the upper cup, and then we have little goblets under it that are there for show, that look nice. And we have kaftor. What's a kaftor?
A button.
Oh, so in modern Hebrew, kaftor is a button. In ancient Hebrew, kaftor was something that looked like a bowl or an apple. So if you look on page 41, you see every time you have the center beam, and then from the menorah, it will protrude to the right and to the left, a branch. Where it protrudes, there's a bowl of gold. That bowl of gold is called a kaftor.
What's a mishukad then?
Mishukad means it has nice engravings. So we have a perach, an engraving of a flower shape. And in a nutshell, we have the base and then the menorah. We know the wicks of the menorah. Two opinions is how they were set up. The classical opinion is that the wicks would all be facing, the flames would all be facing the center flame. And this represents what idea? One understanding is that it represents the idea that in Torah you'll find people pushing to the right and people pushing to the left. So long as they're all focused to the center, to the Ribbono Shel Olam, their intentions are really for the sake of heaven, then it's okay that we have differences. So long as we're facing that same direction. Okay, so we covered a lot for today. Maybe on Thursday, if you guys will have more koach, we'll continue with the story of how the Mishkan was actually built.